Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome back to the Nerd Nest podcast. It's me, it's Rich, it's just the two of us. Just the two of us, you and
just
I.
Just the two of us.
I knew somebody was, I knew that either you were going to start singing, which is probably better, or I was going to start singing, which would have been bad.
It's all good.
Yeah, it is. How you been, man? I haven't seen you in a bit.
I've been good. I went on vacation. I took a little break. It was fun. It was nice. I'm still wearing tropical clothing, so I'm representing my vacation time. I do have an anecdote from my traveling.
Oh, let's hear it.
Yeah. So I actually share this in my upcoming video, but my son and I have both been playing Balatro like crazy, right? Also, by the way, I didn't realize there is a mystique about how you pronounce the name of the game. And
yeah, nobody knows.
And
nobody
the developer knows. Refuses to answer that question. Is it Balatro? Is it Balatro? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's whatever you want it to be.
Exactly. So my son and I have been playing like crazy. So we played it the entire flight. And it's about a four-hour flight. And he played the ROG Ally. He was using the ROG Ally because in case he wants to play Minecraft specifically, because he's a big Minecraft head. And I played on the Steam Deck OLED. And by the time he was out of battery, like he got the first warning, I was down to like 75%. So like the battery life is
wow.
Just... And then I gave him like a battery packet. It wasn't a big one. It was 12,000 milliamp hours. Mm-hmm. He ran that to the ground and I was down to 57%. So I had time to spare.
It seems like that kind of leads into our main discussion today is that these devices, the Steam Deck specifically, because of its low battery usage, they're just perfect for getting your indie games and taking them on the go. And I kind of previewed this in one of my videos and a little live stream where I was talking about the Triple I initiative. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about the conversation that you and I were having in Discord about indies. But before we get to that conversation about like what makes an indie, let's talk about the devices and like the Steam Deck for low power games is crazy good. Because mm-hmm. it's just such an efficient chip. And it's an AMD chip. Like, it's made by AMD. All the other chips in all of these other handhelds, with the exception of the MSI Claw, are also made by AMD. But nothing comes close to the Vanguard chip when it comes to just low power performance.
Yep.
Is that because of the chip? Or is that because of the software and firmware stuff?
Yeah, that's one where I'm probably a little out of my element, right? Like that's one where Carrie and Kyle would go crazy. But I have to imagine it's partly the chip, right? And, you know, Valve has said a lot about, especially early on, about them designing this chip alongside AMD. And I don't know exactly how much input they had, but it's clear that, it's also clear one thing, you know, one point here is that like no other handheld manufacturer is using this. And I think that's intentional, right? Like, I don't think they're allowed to use this chip.
Right. I don't think that we see the whatever chip that NVIDIA made for the Nintendo Switch. I don't think that we see that in other hardware, do we? Maybe the NVIDIA Shield, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. But I don't even know if it's an exclusivity contract per se. It might just be that Valve has like first dibs on any new supply, right? Until that they just run out of demand for the Steam Deck. And maybe the demand is high enough that they're the only ones that can really buy at scale. And so they get all of the inventory. But it's clear that Asus didn't use it. Lenovo didn't use it. And, these handhelds do have their advantage in the having a higher ceiling, but they don't have that power efficiency. I remember Kerry got cooked on Twitter when he said that the Switch OLED had what it delivered in terms of power versus the original Switch was impressive, right? And it's this dichotomy that we don't think of power in terms of power efficiency. And that's what the Switch OLED brings, the power efficiency. And that's what the Steam Deck and the Steam Deck OLED bring as well, as power efficiency and just being able to pump out, like you said, the indie games, certainly the retro games or older games, just being able to do that at a lower TDP and just have longer battery life.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of times you get these companies that are bigger number better. And it's understandable that they do that bigger number better thing. And this isn't really related to gaming, but it's definitely along the same lines. Apple brought out their M series chips and they didn't focus on power. They focused on power per watt is the thing that they kept talking about, because you can have a high ceiling on something like the Lenovo Legion Go or the ROG Ally. And that's great if you want to play those more power hungry games and 100%. You happen to be close to an outlet. But in a handheld device, it is so much more important that you have an efficient chip, which is why when the Nintendo Switch had its first revision, I'm not even talking about to the OLED, there was an original launch Switch, and then there was another one with a different chip. And that different chip had better battery life because it had better power per watt.
Yep.
You know, it didn't make your games perform better. You could just play them for longer. And that's the thing that I feel like Nintendo understands and Valve understands. And all of these other companies, they're laptop manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And so they fall into that, not brain space, but this way of thinking. Yeah. About bigger number better, and they ignore efficiency.
That was also, I've also had that problem with laptops as well, right? I've had gaming laptops over the course of, just my life, and I have one now that my son uses, and you can't use it. You can't actually use it unplugged. You have to plug it in to actually be able to have any decent performance. And, at this point, it's a number of years old. It's 4 or 5 years old. Gaming laptops have gotten better. But my point is that's the space we were in before, right? Where you literally had to plug in. You could take it with you, but when you actually wanted to play video games, you had to plug it in.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. It is solving a problem in a different way. The problem is, I don't want my stuff to be chained to my desk. I want to be able to take it from one place to the next.
Right, right.
And still plug it in. And that makes way more sense for a laptop than it does for a handheld. Although, you get a long enough cord, the handheld doesn't really suffer from being plugged in while you're playing it. So I totally get the people that are like, I want to play the latest, the greatest, the AAA games on my handheld, plugged into the wall, and I don't really care about the battery life. And that's totally a valid way to play.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in indies, not just indies, but lower power games, then I think that the Steam Deck is the way to go.
Yeah.
But let's talk about those indies. We've got this III initiative, which for the viewers and listeners who aren't aware of what this is, basically some of the larger indie devs decided, let's get together and make an event. It's happening on April 10th, I believe. And they're going to unveil some games. They're going to have some demos available. There's going to be some shadow drops as well that they've said. It's about 45 minutes of what they say are bangers. And I'm super excited for it. And I know that you, Rich, are a huge fan of indie games. Like, that is your jam. Those most of the games that you play are indie. Talk about the Triple I initiative, and then we'll get to our conversation about what makes indie indie.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited about the Triple I initiative. I like this. So I've always enjoyed like Devolver, Adult Swim games, rest in peace, Adult Swim games. That sort of like exactly this, right? Like these putting some amount of money marketing behind the indies that you think will be a bigger hit, like the Shovel Knights, the Hollow Knights and things like that. Celeste, right? And so I did. It's a very light prediction. I feel confident that Hollow Knight Silksong will be there because we've seen that it's on, they did the Xbox store page. They did the Switch. It's been rated in Korea. So it does seem like it's going to have like some sort of announcement soon, whether it's release date or something. I think this is the perfect place. Obviously for visibility, a Nintendo Direct or an Xbox showcase would be even better, but I like just selfishly, right? I would love to see that sort of headline this event and make this event even bigger.
Yeah, because people would tune into the event for the Hollow Knight stuff.
Right.
They're the same people that are tuning into Nintendo Directs or Xbox Developer, whatever they call it, I forget, or a State of Play. I don't know if it's going to be on PlayStation. I assume it will eventually. But people tune into that. And if you watch those things live and they've got like the chat on the right hand side, the chat is just flying by with thousands of people watching. Yep. And they're like, Hollow Knight, Silksong, just every constantly talking time. About it. Yes. And then they're disappointed when it doesn't happen, even though nobody promised them that it would.
Yeah, it's I think even the Game Awards, there was chat with like Silksong there too. It's every single event. There are people clamoring for it. And, you know, I'm ready for it too.
Now, you have played the original, right?
I have. I never finished it, so that's definitely a wall of shame. Like, I'm not big on, like, shaming the fact that you have games that you haven't finished, but that is a big one because I enjoyed that game, and so I do want to see it through. But either way, I'm even if I don't, I'm picking up Silksong day one.
Okay, so those of you who have played that game, feel free to let us know in the comments down below that like button if you're watching on YouTube. Do you need to play the first one in order to enjoy the second one? Because I also never finished that game. I probably only played it for about a half an hour. Like, it's on Game Pass, and it suffers from the same thing that all of my other Game Pass games suffer from, is that, oh, I'll get to it.
Yeah.
And so, like, I have it installed on my Xbox, and I played it for a little bit and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I like this. This is neat. But then a new shiny thing distracted me and I'm like, oh, I'll get back to that later. And I never went back to it.
I had the other problem we talk about constantly on this podcast, which is I started it on Switch. So I had like a good 10 hours on Switch. I was like, no, I want to play this on Steam. But, you know, once I got it on Steam, I couldn't like get back to the point I was at, and it just feels a bit like a grind going through it again. But I do want to get back there.
Yeah. So, all right, let's have that conversation. And you know, I'm with you on the wall of shame. It's on my wall of shame as well, as well as many, many other games.
We can band together on that one.
We can. But here, instead of banding together, let's have an argument for a little bit, because you and I were having this conversation, not really an argument, but we were having this conversation, and there was a lot of back and forth about what makes an indie game an indie game. And I was like, this is such a fun conversation that I wanted to do it on the show and record it. So start us off. Tell me what you think.
So this is all born from the question of whether or not Dave the Diver is an indie game. And at the time, during like the Game Awards discourse, I was hesitant to jump into that like conversation, partially because my thoughts may not have been fully formed, but also partially because some of it got like ugly, right? For no reason whatsoever. This should be, in my opinion, just a fun, dumb discussion, right? Right. There should be no reason for this to be like toxic or anything like that. But my strongly held but dumb opinion is that Dave
the Diver finds a way.
Right, like, by the way.
Sorry, go ahead.
My strongly held but dumb opinion is that Dave the Diver is an indie game. So, like, here's my thought. First of all, I think, you know, and I think you agree with this, that language is a living thing. Words take different meaning over a different time. And also, I think, like, taxonomy is a really tricky thing. And sometimes I'm like a little bit nihilistic about taxonomy. Like, there's no way to properly define what a Metroidvania is, right? Like, you will, you can try to define it, and then you'll find an example that sort of defies that explanation or that definition.
Right.
There are two, like, common, I guess, philosophy, like armchair philosophy, things that come to mind. One of them is the chair problem. Like, how do you define a chair? Is it, some people will say it has four legs. Some people will say, but like most of those definitions, you will not match a beanbag. Is a beanbag a chair? Some of those definitions won't match a stool, but a stool is definitely a chair, right?
Right.
So
it's this is the hot dog sandwich conversation, right?
That's
there.
The second one, right?
Yeah.
Is a hot dog a sandwich? and so, like, the chair problem specifically is just like, can you sit on it? That's what most people, like a tree stump, is that a chair? Most people will say you can sit on it. That's a chair, right? And so that's kind of where I'm at with indies, where I don't think you can define it by budget. You can sometimes have a high budget indie, and III Initiative is about higher budget indie. Can you have $300 million budget indie? No, I don't think so. But I'll tell you why.
I'm gonna jump in there real quick. You know, you talk about the III Initiative, and you said high budget indies. We don't necessarily know that these are high budget indies. These are companies that have made their mark already, and they are not necessarily big budget. You know what I mean? But they are big in name recognition. Like, we know who Motion Twin is. Like, we are aware of them. It's not like this little tiny company where you're like, oh, I don't know what else, what other games have they made? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you talk about budget as when indie as a term came out, that's what it was based on, was budget. My argument about Dave the Diver being an indie game is because it feels like an indie game to me, and I'm unaware of their budget.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I feel like is more important, is that does it feel like an indie game? And that's way harder to nail down.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
By the way, I guess we should mention that the reason a lot of people push back on Dave the Diver being indie is because it's not made by an independent studio, right? It's made by not Nexon, but the other one, NetEase. No, it is Nexon, right? Nexon.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's Nexon Publishing, which is a humongous publisher. Like, a lot of people don't, and on our side of the globe, don't know the name, but they are a humongous publisher. So that's why
you're not wrong. It is Nexon.
Cool. And there, even outside of III Initiatives, there are arguably high budget indies. So, for example, I'm going to give it some examples I just looked up. Kena, the Bridge of Spirits, right, is $1 million budget, apparently, which is very low compared to AAA games, but not a small budget for an independent studio, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm just looking here. They included Star Citizen, right? Which is apparently a $600 million budget. Is it Star Citizen?
Well, it's been in development for 48 years or something?
Correct. Correct. I think that example on its own is going to be very controversial. But nonetheless, you could argue it has a $600 million budget. They're independently funded, so to speak. So I think budget's out the window when you define an indie. I think whether or not you have ownership above you may also be out of the window. And I think that's the thing that people stick to, right? The reason I find it out of the window is because, like, you can have partnerships with publishers, right? So there are the developers of Crypt of the Necrodancer. Mm-hmm. They made the Hyrule game, Cadence of Hyrule. Is that an independent game?
They're definitely an independent publisher, developer.
Studio,
but
right.
Yeah, studio. But right. I mean, that was published by Nintendo. So right.
Super tricky.
Yeah, that it is super tricky.
Yeah.
And like there's also the point that does it really matter? It doesn't really matter. Mm-mm. Which mm-hmm. is why I like to go back to that feel. It's like I don't remember who said it. It was like a congressional hearing or something. And they were talking about pornography. And the guy goes, yes. I don't know what porn is, but yes. I know what it is when I see it.
Yes,
and that's how I feel about indie games.
I agree.
Sorry, indie developers. I know what indie is mm-hmm. when I see it.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, the porn, the porn test is one of those. The duck test is the other. You know, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. Right. You know, that's how you – yeah, exactly. So, anyway, I think – for me, what ends up defining indie is how creative it is. And so like I made how, let me change that, how I say that, not how creative it is, how much creative freedom it has as in the process of development. And so I made a chart just for you. Cause you're
I love charts.
So here it is, right?
Is that QWOP on the top left?
That's QWOP. That is quant.
Okay. So yes. Just real quick, I'm going to describe this for the audio listeners.
Go for
We've got the x-axis of our graph is budget.
Yes.
The y-axis is creativity. You've got QWOP, which you mm-hmm. call it QWOP. I always said I QWOP. Call it QWOP.
Yeah.
Okay. You got QWOP on the top left, meaning lots of creativity, not a whole lot of budget. And then you Precisely. Got Modern Warfare 2
yeah.
Is the opposite of that. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, by the way, do you know QWOP, the same developer as Getting Over It, same developer as Baby Steps that is coming out soon, Bennett Foddy?
That doesn't surprise me at all. these are all titles that I would never play.
Fair enough. I really enjoy I enjoy all of his stuff, but I enjoy uh-huh. Getting Over It a ton. Okay. So the other thing I have here on this graph is like a purple line, right? Like connecting QWOP to Modern Warfare. So at the end of one is QWOP and at the end of the other is Modern Warfare. And it goes, it's basically an inverse proportion of creativity to budget, right? Which means that line is sort of the more budget you get, the less freedom for creativity you have. And that is not always the case, but it's a good, I think, heuristic, right? Like the bigger the budget for your game, the less like opportunity you have to take chances to be really novel. That doesn't always play out. There are exceptions to that. And so, but I think like you can pretty much see that, right? Like GTA 5 or GTA 6 is going to be not nearly as creative as Baby Steps, I think, is the good right. example, right? It's you know what to expect more from GTA 6 than you do from Baby Steps. So that's where these are some exceptions, right? So I think Death Stranding to me is sort of above this line where it punches above its weight in terms of creativity. The budget is higher than a typical indie. It's probably in the AAA bracket. But it's really creative when you compare it to GTAs and Call of Duties. And then,
yeah, I can see that. And then what's the game that you've got a little less creativity and a little less budget?
Yeah, this one was tougher for me to pick, but this is Hotline Miami 2. So this is a game that almost undoubtedly most people will call indie, but I would say just by way of being a sequel and sort of an unimaginative sequel to that, right? Like, it's not that creative when you compare it to Hotline Miami 1. And to that extent, it feels like it was made as a bit of not an obligation, but like, you know, people wanted more Hotline Miami. So in making mm-hmm. Hotline Miami 2, you sort of have to adhere to that. And to be fair, Hotline Miami 2 there are ways in which it subverts the expectations, and I'm not going to talk about that. But, you know, generally speaking, the gameplay is pretty much the same as it was the first time around.
You know, I'm going to throw a game on here that I think has a lot of creativity. I have no idea where it would plot because I don't know the budget of this game.
Yeah.
But the DLC for Shovel Knight if you have never played the DLC for Shovel Knight, it's new characters. So they have Spectre Knight, Plague Knight, King Knight.
Yep.
And all three of them play differently. And because all three of them play differently, as you play through the campaign with those characters, Yacht Club had to redesign every level so that those characters could play the game in that different way. And I feel like that was very, very creative, a very creative endeavor.
Absolutely.
But it was only there because they were supported by their, what's it called when fan their, funding? They were supported by their fan funding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their crowdsourcing. And it was like their stretch goals or whatever was that they would add in these other characters, which is just crazy to me the way that they ended up doing that.
Yeah. All of that was so novel. And like, you can see that too, in the sense that like sometimes, at least for me, and this is subjective, but like sometimes it really worked and then sometimes it didn't. And that was okay. Right. Like I forget which one I didn't enjoy. I don't know if it was the, poison one or something, but like, you know, some of those different nights were a lot more enjoyable than some of the other ones. And I think that was just them like, you know, trying something new. And like I said, sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. All right. So with indie, right? Well, before we get to indie, AAA is pretty easy to define. It's objective. And this is it here where it's like above some budget threshold. I don't know if that's 300 million, 100 million, 500 million, but above some budget threshold is basically where people are calling what people are calling AAA games. And to me, that's sort of what indie is. Above some creative threshold is what indie is. So I think Dave the Diver would be somewhere above this because it is a novel game. Just because it was, despite the fact that it was funded by a big publisher. By the way, we don't know what the budget is, right? So it may still have been a small budget to your point from earlier. But despite the fact that it was funded by a big publisher, this was a publisher that was willing to take a risk on something. And that is the only place where I think maybe defining indie is somewhat important. Like because for me, the value in this is that it's an opportunity for me to celebrate these more novel titles, right? So the fact that we can focus on novelty or creativity as like the axis, I think is like when AAA publishers like Ubisoft makes a game like Grow Home, I can now celebrate that. I'm going to celebrate it regardless, but I think this list lends to my celebration.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. This, for the audio listeners on the graph, he has like this horizontal line along the y-axis. And if you're above that horizontal line, then you are considered an indie game. And again, this graph has no numbers on it. So we don't, it's intentionally. So you can't point to an indie game and say that's indie because they spent this much money on it, or that's indie because it's this amount of creativity. It's just, this is an indie game because I think it's an indie game. And to every single person, that's going to be a different bullseye. It's a different target that people look at. And so you have this discussion about whether or not something is indie. And if it's backed by, like, you can have an indie studio, like the whichever one we were talking about before, I've forgotten now.
Yeah,
you can have that indie
dancer studio.
Yeah, I don't know exactly.
Yeah,
right. You can have that studio, and then they can make something really cool, and then a publisher can say, "Oh, you know what? You guys made this cool thing. We will publish it for you. Take care of all of the marketing stuff, and then you guys are all set with your game." And that's an important thing that needs to continue to happen. And I think it's one of the good things that these big companies can do is find indies and give them a chance, because which is what III is trying to do right now. They're trying to find a way to show off a bunch of indie games that may not have these big publishers behind them.
Yep.
Anything else on the graph?
No, but no, I'll stop sharing too. But like what you were just saying and what, you know, we were talking about with Cadence of Hyrule, that's sort of a good segue into the next, into the other topic that we were going to talk about.
I've forgotten what your
Dead Cells developer releasing or working on a new Prince of Persia.
Yeah, before we talk about that, mm-hmm. that is a good segue. We are recording this live, and I shared the link out with patrons and with YouTube channel members. And we've got somebody in here, Kodiak. He says, I asked him, what do you think of an indie game? And he says, oh, a game that isn't created by bigger established studios. So for example, Hades has an amazing creativity and is probably just on the boundary of on the budget side, but I guess that's just my opinion of it. And that's, again, opinion.
Super
this
valid.
Really is super, super important is everybody has their own opinion on it. I hear your keyboard clicking. Are you looking up the budget for Hades or something?
I was. I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it, but I really want to know. And, you know, to that point, what is the budget of Hades 2, right? Because they've been the studio that has consistently been able to make a success that usually was bigger than their last one. I think Pyre was probably one that wasn't as big as whatever came previous. But, you know, they came with Bastion, Transistor, and then I forgot what other ones, Pyre. But then Hades just blew all of those out of the water. And I think Hades 2, I mean, I'm sure that has at least a $1 million budget, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and according to Kodiak in chat, he says Hades had an investment by Epic, if memory serves, during early access. So
yeah,
they did have some money behind them.
That's a good point, right? Like, I do consider any of those exclusivity deals, like whether it's Game Pass, Epic Game Store, I always consider those as I mean, it's funding, right? So
yeah,
just like crowdfunding, it's an opportunity usually for that developer to potentially do something that they weren't going to be able to do because they got, you know, another $10 million or $500,000, whatever it is. Yeah, same with Satisfactory. That's true.
Yeah, and you know what else is it? I don't want to get distracted because, you know, you brought up the Dead Cells thing, so I do want to get back to that. But mm-hmm. I read a story about somebody was interviewing somebody at GDC, and basically they were saying, you know, we used to be able to get – there were more deals out there. Yeah. To get your indie game on Game Pass. There were more deals out there to get some exclusivity onto the Epic Games Store.
Yeah.
And currently, those deals seem to have dried up. They're not really around as much anymore. Yeah. Almost like Microsoft and Epic Games Store have looked at those expenses and said, Is it giving us a return on our investment by doing these exclusivity deals and giving away all these games? Who knows?
Yeah.
And that's just an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think what happens with a lot of these things, and Steam to an extent is included in this as well, is that the indie developers or the indie games are usually like the on-ramp, right? So like mm-hmm. you start with an indie developer, you start with indie games, hopefully you have some hits that gives you some cachet, and now you can negotiate with like the AAA publishers and Ubisoft and things like that to get their games in your subscription or stuff like that. And that happened to an extent, like I said, with Valve, where like for a long time, Steam was carried, in my opinion, by indie games. So like,
oh yeah,
that first 10 years, like 2003 to 2013, like AAA publishers were very hesitant to publish their games on Steam. And this was happening at the same time as sort of the XBLA explosion, right? And so indie games really were a reason to be on Steam. You can get them affordably. You can have a good time. And I think Valve still, like Steam Next Fest, right? Like they still really cater to indie developers. So They're one of the best in this way, I think. But they do give these sort of sweetheart deals to the AAA publishers that bring in a lot of money once you start bringing in, I think it's over $10 million in revenue, maybe $100 million. I don't know. Don't quote me. But once you bring in a certain amount of revenue, you get charged a lower fee by Valve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, that makes a ton of sense. And that's a recent development, right? Like that wasn't something that they'd been doing for a while.
Yeah, I want to say last 5 years, like around the time Epic Game Store became a thing, like right before that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that that's absolutely something to consider as well. But you know what? Back to the perfect segue that I ruined because I couldn't pay attention to stuff. But we've got an exclusive over at Insider Gaming. This is from Tom Henderson, who's very, very reliable stuff. And I'm trying to put it on screen right now for the video listeners, for the people watching over on YouTube. exclusive Dead Cells developer that's Motion Twin, by the way, to release a new Prince of Persia game in Steam Early Access. So first off, there was just a new Prince of Persia game, like what, 3 months ago? Like, isn't that when that one came out? The one that just released Lost Kingdom or something?
Yep.
Right. And now we've got a new one made by Motion Twin
Lost Crown. Sorry. That was
Lost Crown, not Lost. Yeah. Kodiak in chat is saying it's Motion Twin, it's Evil Empire.
Yeah, so I was going to mention this. There's actually, I think a lot of people don't know, there's actually a lot of drama at Motion Twin. Well, we're probably past the drama now, but like some people defected from Motion Twin to form their own studio. I don't remember which is which, but I guess Motion Twin were the ones that were going to continue making Dead Cells content. But anyway, I guess some of those folks created the studio named Evil Empire, and they're the ones that are going to be, slated for this game.
Right. And Evil Empire, I'm pretty sure that they are part of the III initiative, right?
That sounds correct.
I feel like I was reading a story about it and they were being interviewed, and it was one of the people from Evil Empire had a quote about the III initiative and why they were doing it. So I would expect that we're going to find out more about this we're recording this on Sunday. Probably on the 10th. And, when we see that it's Evil Empire, not Motion Twin. So my apologies for screwing that up, but we've got this new Prince of Persia game coming to Steam Early Access. Let's answer this question. Is this indie? Because Evil Empire, that's a small studio.
I do have an answer for this.
Backed by Ubisoft, right?
Yeah. I do have an answer for that, but it's not a yes. It's not a yes or a no. It's not binary. It's a prompt. Is Baldur's Gate 3 indie?
That's so hard to like. I don't know how much money.
Yeah.
That was we can't define it by budget, but part of my brain goes that direction.
Yeah.
How much money did Wizards of the Coast throw at Larian Studios to help support the development of this game?
So if I go back to my way of thinking, right, which is not the money, but instead the creative freedom, how much creative freedom did Larian Soft have to make Baldur's Gate 3? And obviously we don't know the answer to that, but also obviously that freedom is not infinite because we're working with an IP. Right.
So not just an IP, but an IP with very specific rules.
Exactly.
And they had to follow those rules. Exactly. Otherwise, it's not Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly. So I personally do not, and everybody is subject to their own opinion, but I personally do not consider Baldur's Gate 3 indie. And that is because of the limited creative freedom. I know people are going to argue that in the comments, but that's my take.
I'm looking forward to reading the comments on this one. It's going to be fun.
I know. So with this, I think that this follows some of the same logic. I think they'll have more creative freedom in terms of a Prince of Persia game. That is a lot more open in some ways than maybe Dungeons and Dragons. I know a lot of people were upset that you don't play as the prince in this Prince of Persia game. So I guess.
In the new one?
Yeah. You don't play as the prince. You play basically as one of his bodyguards.
Okay.
Yeah.
As I've played multiple Prince of Persia games, I don't know that I've ever given a damn about who my character is.
Me neither.
Like, I go into a dungeon and hopefully I don't fall onto some spikes.
Yeah.
Going all the way back to the original one way back in the day.
Yeah.
What do you Kodiak, think?
Is this indie? Oh, yeah, sorry.
This one?
Yeah, Prince of Persia. The Prince of Persia by Dead Cells, developer, Evil
it's
Empire.
It's so hard to say. I know that they're an evil, or evil, goddamn. I know that they're, first off, don't name your company Evil.
They
right?
No, you got to understand. Let me read you one of, they did this on purpose, clearly. Let me read you one of the sentences. It says,
okay.
It's understood that the game has been in development for the past 4 years and happened thanks to a discussion between Evil Empire and Ubisoft at GDC around 2019, soon after Evil Empire was born. Like, every sentence is just made better by the fact that their name is Evil Empire.
You're not wrong.
Yeah.
So are they indie? It's so hard for me to say yes because they've got the backing of Ubisoft. I feel like, you know, you look at the graph that you made. I'm going to guess that the creative freedom is pretty limited. Like, they make the game, they probably submit it to Ubisoft. Ubisoft says change these 87 things. And, you know, they're restricting it because they have access to the purse strings.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, Kodiak's in the chat, like an indie studio, but not an indie game. It's tricky, but yeah, I don't know where we draw the line, but this is where I am drawing my line. It's creative freedom. It's a little fuzzy, but that's where I'm going with it.
So did you answer about this game? I know I didn't.
I'll say it depends, but my gut feeling is it's not indie. If I have to give it a yes or no, it's not indie because of the limited freedom.
And would you say the same thing about Cadence of Hyrule?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this feels like a Cadence of Hyrule situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Which, by the way, I do.
Yeah.
Even going back to like what I said, do we want more of this? I absolutely want so much more of this. Like,
yeah.
I want more independent developers being tapped for established IP. And I think, like, to me, it's sort of unquestionable that it makes for good games, and it sort of offsets some of the risk. It mitigates some of the risk for the publisher, because when they are, like, Nintendo has been doing this pretty consistently with Cadence of Hyrule and just outsourcing some games to other developers.
The new Peach game.
Yeah, the new Peach game, exactly. They had Platinum Studios in their kind of back pocket for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It means that your studios are not tied up on the games that you think are riskier, because they don't have this, like the Metroid games, right? Like they're obviously a very important IP to Nintendo, but they also know that it's not going to have the ceiling in sales that a Mario or any other Mario, Animal Crossing and Pokemon, right? Like those are probably the three big ones.
Yeah. And you wouldn't consider, Let's look at Metroid Prime 4.
Yeah.
Being made by Retro Studios for Nintendo. Nintendo tried to make it themselves. They said, oh, this sucks. Yeah. Let's get Retro Studios to do it and throw everything in the garbage and start over.
Yep.
Is that indie? Because Nintendo's not making it. I feel like the answer is no for me.
Yeah, I think the answer is no. I don't know. I also don't know. Isn't Retro partially owned by Nintendo?
That I have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd have to look it up. But even if they weren't, yeah, I still don't think it's indie. I think Nintendo has a very, I think with Metroid Prime that there was a lot of creative freedom, clearly the original Metroid Prime. But at the same time, there was heavy oversight from the Japanese headquarters.
Yeah. I think that I agree with that. Yeah. But regardless, this is a super fun conversation about what makes an indie game. So here's my question to everybody who's watching this. leave a comment down below that like button with a game that you think is not an indie game, but is made by an indie studio. Like, I would love to see more examples of that. Perfect examples would be Cadence of Hyrule, this new Prince of Persia game, that kind of stuff. I'm curious about what you all think about that. Let's move on and talk about something that is not indie, but super, super important. We've got this article that I just got a pop-up blocker for from Windows Central. And the article says that Xbox President Sarah Bond has set up a new team dedicated to game preservation and forward compatibility. This is awesome to hear. They said the backward compatibility program will continue to future Xbox hardware. So they're coming right out and saying, in the future, whatever you buy for Xbox is going to be on your next Xbox as well, and it will continue to move forward. And that's something that no console maker has ever really committed to. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, we've had consoles that have had backwards compatibility, but we never had console makers come out and say, we're going to do this. And that's one of the things about, like, PC that is so compelling is the fact that you have the... you know that your next computer is still going to be able to play these games no matter what that computer is. I mean, unless you buy a Mac, no matter what computer you end up buying, it's going to be able to play these games, and you are able to bring your library forward. And, you know, they're saying we're going to continue to do this. And that's something that I am always concerned with when it comes to backwards compatibility and game preservation. I love that they are coming out and saying this. What are your thoughts on that, Rich?
Yeah, I love it too. I have, like, what's weird to me about this quote or this statement is that I didn't know they needed a team for this. And I don't want to trivialize, because, like, a lot of people do a lot of important work, right? But what I mean is they seem to have figured out, like, not emulation, but backwards compatibility for the existing legacy systems, right? Mm-hmm. For the most part, they have some games that are not compatible, things like that, but they seem to have figured it out. They have a large library of compatible games, and they pretty much stopped working on legacy systems. So this statement seems like a commitment to, like you said, keep backwards compatibility working in the future, which... If they're continuing to use x86 architecture, I wonder why they feel the need to say that we will be committed to this. Because if they're using x86 architecture, that should be fairly trivial, right? Like PS4 to PS5, backwards compatible, no question. So I'm not saying that this means that they're working on something else. I just wonder what challenges they have ahead of them for backwards compatibility, that they feel like they need a larger team or some team that is specifically dedicated to this.
Yeah. Because you're thinking that the team is there to port stuff, right?
That's a good point. I don't know. I wonder if maybe, right. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe it's something else.
Well, there's a quote here in the article, and here's what she says. We formed a new team dedicated to game preservation, important to all of us at Xbox and the industry itself. We are building on a strong history of delivering backwards compatibility to our players and remain committed to bringing forward an amazing library of Xbox games for future generations of players to enjoy. And here's what I'm thinking. You know, they said that they formed a team. That doesn't mean that that's the only thing that those people do. Like,
sure. Yeah.
When I like, for instance, the school that I work at is right in the path of the eclipse. So there were people who were getting together and talking about what were we going to do for the eclipse, that kind of thing. In addition to that, I also have, like, my real job. You know, I have that stuff going on. So I'm sure that there's people who are working at Xbox.
Yeah.
Who also have like their real jobs, but they're also on the game preservation task force or whatever. Like
Strike Force kind of. Yeah, exactly.
Strike Force.
Yes.
It exactly. only counts if you say it like that.
Yeah, my bad.
So I love that they're doing this. Mm-hmm. Is it necessary if they're maintaining the same architecture? I mean, up until now, up until this generation, I feel like every new generation, there was a new architecture that you had to figure out. But now these consoles, they're just computers, essentially. Like, they're very, very streamlined computers. They don't have all the crazy stuff like the – what was the PS3 that made it really hard to work with?
The cell architecture. Cell
processor or whatever. Like this is basically off the shelf components that they're not really, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And because of that, it makes it easier to keep this backwards compatibility or forward compatibility going.
Right. I will say, if I were to speculate, right, like Microsoft has been, especially now with Apple and M1, Microsoft has been heavily flirting with ARM. And so it's possible that we see a future Xbox with sort of an ARM architecture. And if that's the case, that would be huge if they are working on some sort of x86 to ARM translation specifically for Xbox, right? So maybe it wouldn't be open source like Proton is, but even if they are working on that, that would be huge.
It would be huge. You know, Apple did that with Rosetta in order to switch from their PowerPC chips to Intel, and then from Intel to the M1 chips. Valve is doing the same thing with the Steam Deck, with Proton, and, you know, Microsoft doing this with their promised next generational leap that we're supposed to be seeing sometime this year, whether or not it comes out this year, but something that they're going to show off this year. Yeah. All of that stuff is things that they keep saying. But I love that they're committing to forward compatibility. Part of me thinks that, you know, that it could just be, I mean, not saying that they're lying, but it could be just be like, hey, this is our way of marketing. Buy your games on Xbox because they're going to be on your future Xbox as well.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Sorry. A lot of their marketing points right now, it seems like they're really going towards being a PC, right? Like the lines are blurring everywhere. So like with Valve making the Steam Deck, I feel like the lines got blurred, but everything that Microsoft has been saying recently, it feels like they're blurring those lines, whether it's Epic Game Store or other stores. They didn't say Epic Game Store specifically, but they said stores coming to Xbox.
No, they did say Epic Game Stores.
The only one
that they didn't say was Steam.
Did they actually say Epic Game Store and itch.io?
That was the way
The Verge put it forth, but I wasn't sure.
Well, now I'm not positive, but like my memory tells me that they said Epic Game Store, but that could have just been the way that the article was written.
And either way, right? Like Epic Game Store is the obvious choice given sort of Epic's crusade currently, right? So like clearly if Microsoft were to open things up in any way, Tim Sweeney's going to be the first one through that door.
Let's take a second because you posted something in our Discord this morning about the other stores on Xbox. You want to bring that up?
Yeah. And this is just a stray thought, right? Like it was like, makes you think. So I haven't thought it through too much, but I said, I'm trying to find it specifically exactly what I said. It's funny, there's so much pushback to the idea that Xbox is flirting with the idea of having other storefronts. Like I've seen people say, how could they afford that? But outside of that, people find it completely obvious that Valve is going to sell enough Steam games such that they can afford selling the Steam Decks either at a loss or some sort of subsidized cost where the margins are razor thin. Like we all take for granted that, sure, Valve can sell whole ass PCs, part of my language. They can sell whole PCs basically that where you can, you know, use Epic Games Store, GOG, itch.io, whatever, and they'll make enough profit. But for some reason for Microsoft, it's brought into question whether or not they're going to make enough money. I have my thoughts on that, but I can speak to them, but it's not fully formed yet.
Well, okay. So first off, for the Steam Deck, there's no easy way. Yeah, there's desktop mode. You could do whatever the hell you want there. But there's no easy way to get to the other stores. Mm-hmm. And all but the hardcore users are, they're just going to boot it up in Steam and just buy their games from Steam. So I don't see the Steam Deck as somebody, I don't see people using that with other stores as like their primary way of doing things. But if the Xbox suddenly had the Epic Games Store on there and you got weirdos like me who not like me, cause I stopped doing it. But at first I had an alarm that would go off every month to remind me, hop on the Epic Games Store and get your free stuff, or every week or whenever it was. I can't remember now, but you would just get all this free stuff. And all that stuff is like attached to my account. If suddenly I have access to all of that stuff on my Xbox, I'm going to spend a whole lot less money on the Xbox store. At the same time,
it's as seamless as it is on Xbox.
Yes, it has to be seamless. If it's if it's like a huge workaround where like you got to buy it from another store and then like. Like when Apple, if you wanted to like subscribe to somebody on Twitch or whatever, you had to like buy a coin or something, like that kind of extra currency, too much of a pain, then people just won't do it. But if you also look at the Xbox, people aren't buying games on Xbox. They just play Game Pass.
Yeah. I this was just a stray that I shot. So I haven't thought through too much. But
it's fun.
It's fun. And I just, do you think that if, let's say it was, you had to jump through a few hurdles, not like monetarily, but just like, you know, it becomes a little more PC. Like when, let's say Steam would be on Xbox, but it becomes a little more PC, like where you have to go to like a desktop sort of mode. You have to like download, you know, Steam, and then it doesn't have the convenience of the Xbox games. Would you use that? I certainly would.
Absolutely. In fact, on my Steam Deck, I never, ever buy anything from the Steam Deck. I always use my phone. I go into my phone or my computer. But I go into the store on my phone or on the computer and I buy it that way because the Steam store on the Steam Deck chugs. Like it's just kind of slow.
Yeah.
And it's not fun to use. Like if I'm searching through stuff and I hit the back button, it doesn't go back to where I was just looking. It goes back and then scrolls up to the top or something. And then I'm like, come on, this is terrible. It is a bad experience. And I'm not a fan of that. So if I would go on my phone and buy a game on Steam and then on my Xbox, I could launch that game. Absolutely. I would use that 1,000% because I would buy all of my games from Steam. Because if I can buy them all from Steam, then I can use them on my computer. I can use them on my Xbox. I can use them on my Steam Deck, on my Ally, on my Legion Go. I could use them on everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that Microsoft has to, I think, you know, why Microsoft would do this. I don't know what Valve is going to do, but I think Microsoft has to consider the fact that maybe Valve will release some sort of set-top box. Maybe one day it'll be available in retail shelves. And what would that look like in terms of being competition to Xbox, right? You have something where you can just easily download a Steam game, play a Steam game, and it may be in competition just in terms of performance with an Xbox. And so like, how can Microsoft beat that? That seems like it would be a tough thing for them to beat.
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely think so. But I think as Kerry said in the chat that he said something along the lines of Microsoft could lose $2 trillion and still have $2 trillion or something like that. So
yeah, he said lose $2 trillion and still have $1 trillion. And Microsoft can afford to do whatever Microsoft wants to do at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, no question.
All right, let's move on and talk about, you know, in related to what Sarah Bond said about preserving games. There's this new initiative called the Stop Killing Games campaign, which I love the idea of this, and I'm just going to throw it up on screen. Basically, this is from PC Gamer. It says, gamers seek legal win that would stop developers from rendering online games unplayable, and it's an assault on consumer rights and the preservation of media.
Yeah.
In short, basically, the idea behind Stop Killing Games is if you're going to shut down a game that requires online play, or you have to have servers in order to play it, then you need to give the players access. This is something we've talked about a million times.
Yep.
You got to give them a way to duplicate that experience before you shut it down, so the people who spent money on it can continue to use the thing that they spent money on. Yep. The perfect example for this is Marvel Heroes. Marvel Heroes was this awesome Diablo clone that was an MMO where you would play as Marvel characters. And then when Disney bought Marvel, they shut it down and said, it's all gone now. And there were people who had hundreds of hours into that game, and they poured tons of money. Now, luckily, Disney's deep pockets allowed them to give everybody refunds, which is great. But that's not always something that happens. You know, you look at other games like Asheron's Call 2. This was this really cool game. It was a sequel to one of my favorite MMOs ever. I played it. It wasn't amazing, but people didn't stick with it. And so it ended up getting shut down and you cannot play it anymore. I'm sure that there's ways that you can like do it through like hacked servers or whatever, but not officially. The only official time when this has really happened that I know of off the top of my head would be City of Heroes, where the people who made the game eventually capitulated and said, all right, here's all of the stuff that you need to continue making the your fan version of City of Heroes. And they gave that over, which is awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, another game I think of when I think of like a graceful shutdown, I'll share my screen here, is Knockout City. So Knockout City is another online only game.
Great game, by the way.
Really good game. Really, really damn good game. And they had to shut down their servers. They couldn't keep it up. But they, you know, I haven't followed up on this, but I assume it's out by now. They promised to have a private hosted server version so that you can still play the game on a private hosted server. So they would release the binaries that you need to still play that game. You would just have to, you know, host a server somewhere. So theoretically, you should still be able to play Knockout City. And, you know, they did that again pretty gracefully. And I think that was a nice way of handling it. I also want to point out that, and I'll share my screen again here for another one. If you go to that website, this is something I was really happy about, the Stop Killing Games website, which is a lot of times these sort of like campaigns are just
complaints.
They just meant exactly just yeah, complaints. They just,
I don't like this.
Yeah. Just manufacture like discussion, but no action. And the first thing, like the biggest button here on this website is to take action. And then from there, like you can look at which country you're in. So if I'm in the United States, it tells you like three actions that you can take and how impactful each of these actions are. So if you want to contact the DGCCRF, which I don't know what that is, they rate that as a medium high priority. So that would be more impactful than contacting the FTC, which they rate as a low priority. And then they give you the steps to do it, which include, you know, screenshots, where to go, what sort of account to create. Like they really did the legwork of making sure that this means something and isn't just generating online debate.
Yeah. And I love that there's a little asterisk on there that says in order to take part of this thing, like if you close that, it says you have to own The Crew, which is another online game that apparently got shut down due to music licensing, due to cars licensing. The licensing ran out. And so the publisher has no choice but to shut down the game, which sucks because the license ran out. And like, this is the kind of thing where these licenses should be granted in perpetuity for that game. So the crew, you know, the crew comes out and you're granted the license to put a Porsche in the game, and that game will always have access to that car. But then when you go to make the crew 2, you got to make that deal again.
Yeah. Or just have a graceful shutdown plan, right? Like, if you know that these licenses may expire and you are not able to get them, then have an option for non-licensed, non-licensed versions of those assets, whether it's cars, music, whatever.
Yeah, I absolutely replace the Porsche with the Corsche or something. I don't know. Yeah. I just made up a thing.
Yeah.
Another discussion that I thought would be interesting is I posted this on my YouTube channel. I said, Steam Deck fans. No, not that one. Oh, it's not showing the one that I was looking for. Well, I can mention it real quick. Noah from Steam Deck HQ just started a new subreddit, which you can find over at reddit.com/r/Steam Deck HQ. That is not the post that I thought that I was linking. So I got to try and find it. But basically, I was asking, look, we have rumors. Not really rumors, because Asus has all but said that they're making an ROG Ally 2, and it's coming soon. And one of the things that people complain about with the ROG Ally is battery life. And another is that they wish that it was a OLED screen. Both perfectly reasonable, you know, things that somebody might bring up. So I said, well, if you had to choose between those two things, like you could pick only one, would you want it to have a, hopefully this is the, here, let me close that. There we go. Would you want it to have a bigger battery or an OLED screen? And we had over 3,000 votes. 55% said bigger battery. 45% said OLED screen. Where are you landing on this, Rich?
It's tough. I'm going to cheat. And I'm not going to say both. I'm not going to cheat that way. But here's how I'm going to cheat. An OLED screen would help with battery life.
It would.
so I'm going to go assuming OLED VRR, right? Because here's the thing. The ROG Ally screen is really, really nice. Really nice, right? Like I don't miss OLED when I'm using the ROG Ally. It's a beautiful screen. So I don't need the OLED. But OLED VRR would be really nice. And it should help with battery life. So I haven't voted yet, so I'm going to vote right now. OLED screen.
Yeah. All right. That's fair. I would prefer to have better battery life.
Yeah.
I don't know if a big, like, I know that they said that they wanted to get, when they first announced the first one, they were harping about the weight. And I don't think that the weight was nearly as much of an issue. This thing needs a bigger battery. If it's going to have a chip by AMD or God forbid Intel, then it's going to be a power hungry monster that's going to chew through battery. And so you need to have a much bigger battery in there, or a more efficient chip. For me, I would want better battery life over the OLED screen only because the ROG Ally screen is so damn good. It's really, really fantastic.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about it, like, because I battery life would be more impactful to me again than just the screen. Right. But if again, you could only pick one, which, and I guess this answers the question, just the poll itself. Right. But like, which one would give consumers more reason to pick it up? And that's tough, but I think
you put OLED on the box.
Exactly.
And a lot of people are going to reach for that. That's the thing, is like, they've seen the Nintendo Switch, and then they saw the Nintendo Switch OLED and they were like, whew, that's nice. Yeah. We had the Steam Deck LCD and then the Steam Deck OLED. it's a gorgeous screen. It just looks so good. And while the ROG Ally screen is really good, putting those four letters on the box might shift quite a bit more than somebody saying 60 watt hour battery or you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think that is going to do it for this episode. Rich, what videos you got coming next, my man?
So I have a video coming where I basically talk about my thoughts on a Steam Deck 2. And a lot of it, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant again before we drop.
Let's hear it. Like, I love rants.
A lot of it is like, you know, people are looking for an incremental upgrade to the Steam Deck. They're like, I want a little bit more powerful of an APU because I want it now, right? Like, that's what people want. People want a Steam Deck 2 now. Some people, not our audience typically, but just the people that want a more powerful Steam Deck. So a lot of people that, you know, have an ROG Ally or something like that. I'm like,
anybody who wants to push the gaming envelope, maybe play Dragon's Dogma 2.
You're right. Exactly. Right. And I just don't see it that way. Like, it's not that that's not important to me. It's that I want a Steam Deck 2 to be bigger than that. Right. And like, when I think about what I want from a Steam Deck 2, I think a lot of people would say I'm being unrealistic. And then that just makes me think, like, if I told you about the Steam Deck in 2019, like, you would throw water at me. Like, you would not believe me if I told you that there would be a handheld gaming PC for $400 that plays games, almost your entire Steam library, on Linux and can have, you know, 3+ hours of battery life. Like, you would not believe me if I told you that.
When did it get announced?
Was 2021.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So
yeah, you're right. People wouldn't have believed that.
Yeah, at all. So yeah, I want to be as unrealistic with my like desire for a Steam Deck 2. So that I talk about what I think the Steam Deck 2 should be. And it's a little out there.
I'm looking forward to watching that one. That one will be fun.
Yeah.
I just put out a video about emulation on iOS. So you guys can find that over at youtube.com/nerdnest. You can find Rich's video over at youtube.com/fanthedeck. And this is something I'm really bad at, but I never tell people about the Patreon. If you want to get the podcast without any ads in it, then you can subscribe to the Patreon over there'll be a link in the description down below because I can never remember the URL. Make sure that you check that out if that's something you're interested in. And in the future, if we do these live recordings, that's where I post when we're going to do a recording where people can come in and watch live and be part of the show like Matt was earlier. So have an awesome day, everybody. And from the Nerd Nest, stay rad.